and welcome to this episode of Military History Inside Out, presented by War Scholar. Today I speak with Norman Friedman for a second time, this time about his book on U.S. submarines since 1945. We get into the changes that have occurred between 1994, you know, just past the end of the Cold War, to present day. Then we step back to back in time to 1945 up through the 1960s, discuss some of the technological changes, some of the political and budgetary considerations that had to be made as the submarine force has sort of changed in size and focus since 1945. We talk about some of the new information he's found on old submarine issues that people had conjectured about, but since they didn't have full information about, they in some cases they got conclusions wrong. So Norman talks about some of the changes in thinking that he and others have gone through as far as certain submarine issues. So definitely a good talk about Cold War issues and the U.S. Navy submarine force. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Norman Friedman, author of U.S. Submarines Since 1945, Revised Edition, An Illustrated Design History. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
Obviously, the title tells us about the book. Can you tell me how you came about writing it?
Well, I'm interested in the U.S. Navy. If you try to go through what the Navy consists of, submarines are an important part. If you want to know where the Navy came from, which is usually what I care about, you want the whole story, and submarines are an important part of that story, increasingly important since World War II. So I had less information available because submarines tend to be more secret. One of the reasons for doing a revision is that material has become declassified since I wrote the original book, so that I can compare what I thought at that time, to some extent, with what's come out. And what's come out tends to make a richer story. The other thing that was new, well, there are, obviously since 1994, which is a long time ago, a lot has happened. But also, there are two famous submarine losses, and a lot more has come out about how they were lost and why. Very good analysis has been done, particularly by a man who studied Navy acoustics. So we spent a lot of money during the Cold War listening. And although we were looking to listen to Russian subs, we also heard our own subs. And he managed to listen to recordings of both of those losses, and he concluded very interesting things. And I would regard his conclusions as more authoritative than what's been out before. They're quite different from what's been out before, by the way.
So tell me about the sort of the major technological changes then that you've seen in the past, I guess, quarter century.
Well, the biggest change is that since the Cold War, the Navy has involved mostly in dealing with rogue states and a more limited area, and it's an area on land. So you don't think of a submarine as having much to do with that, and they've spent enormous effort to make it possible to get engaged in places like the Middle East. So submarines first are very valuable for collecting intelligence, because if they're really invisible, those who are being collected don't know it. That's the best way. Second, they're very good as platforms for special forces. And the most extreme version of that was the conversion of missile subs into basically special forces projection subs. That's something quite new. The ability of submarines to connect to the rest of the world has gone way up, mostly through satellites. That's been a major development that I don't think submarine officers would have imagined before the early 2000s.
Interesting. So that it sounds like it makes them more, well, in one way you can have a more higher level command of them, for better or for worse.
Well, it's also they can transmit back things. So, for example, a submarine in the forward area can explore the area. It can try to detect minefields. It can try to detect possible landing beaches. And it can do so on the quiet. The big thing about submarines is invisibility. So then the question is, well, how does it get the information back home? And it used to be, well, you can come back at the end of your patrol, hand in your report. Well, that doesn't do much good. So what they spent a lot of time learning is how to get that information back real time, usually with high-speed satellite links. Now, that means they give up some of their invisibility when they're blasting away on the satellite, but they felt that that was a worthwhile compromise. That was a big deal. Another big deal is that if you look around the last, 30 or 40 years, what you see is an explosion in computer capability. And what they realized at the end of the Cold War was that they wanted to have better sensing, but they couldn't afford better sensors. They couldn't afford larger sonar arrays or more sensitive ones. What they could afford was much better computer processing of what came through. And that turned out to be an extremely good idea, to the point where they're able to refresh some of the computers in the submarine. I think it's every year and a half or 2 years, which has had an enormous impact. Now, obviously, they don't talk about exactly what they've gained, but every time you talk, it's, wow, look at this. And I think that's been one of the biggest developments. Look, our world is very largely driven by more and more powerful computers. That may stop at some point, but right now it's pretty hot. So the question is, how do you take advantage of that? Especially in the military world where basically things change pretty slowly. And they change slowly because if something goes really wrong, people get killed. They figured out a way around that. And to me, that's the biggest change has been. It's invisible. It's something inside steel hull that you'll never see. But that was extremely smart. Called rapid acoustic hot insertion. Well, no, I got the acronym wrong, but ARCI, acoustic rapid COTS insertion. Sorry, I knew I was saying the acronym wrong. And that became a model for other things in the Navy, because it turns out that in a lot of cases, if you can run much more powerful software, the hardware that you thought was kind of useless turns out to be a lot better than it was. That's a very big thing. And that deserves a lot of publicity. It's a very, very smart move. Similarly, if you look at weapons that don't seem to change over time, like say a torpedo, the ability to insert better computer hardware and better software that works with it really changes how well that works. And people who look at these things typically look at a bit of hardware, like a torpedo or a missile. And there's no sense of, wait a minute, if I put this little better chip in there, which costs like $5, suddenly I can run software which someone has written, which is very much more clever, and all of a sudden I have a completely different system. That's pretty good. And that leverages what we're very good at. So, an interesting thing.
Yeah.
I felt good talking about that. I felt good writing about that.
Oh, okay, yeah. I was going to ask what may seem to be a trivial question, but considering how sensitive computer systems are to moisture and heat and cold and that sort of thing, how are computer systems dealt with in a submarine?
Well, you have to enclose them in something that keeps them happy. But this, compared to the size of the computer, there's a lot of space. I mean, submarines are pretty tight in general, but the computers that have been around that we're comfortable with are very small. Now, I'm staring at a laptop, which, what is it, 12 by 14 or something like that? It's a tiny thing which is extremely powerful. So the system that they use involves enclosures for computers. The enclosures keep them happy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would think submarines now, since they're air conditioned, are probably reasonably dry internally.
Okay.
I know they used to sweat a lot, and they used to be quite wet.
Mm-hmm.
But they do better now, and I think that hasn't been a problem for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Quite a while. Again, I'm somebody saying, sitting in an apartment writing about this stuff, as opposed to someone writing a sub. I may be giving it too much credit.
Hmm. Yeah.
But if you look throughout the Navy, heavy duty computing is everywhere. Certainly you see that on surface ships and Aegis and things like that. And so, they've been living with that for a long time. This is not some new discovery of what can go wrong.
Right.
And I would think that as the ships get more powerful, you're able to package them more safely.
Mm-hmm. Now,
looking at a monitor that doesn't go on, I'm not so sure everything works, but that's why.
Mm-hmm. Since your book does start at 1945, can we sort of take a little bit of a step back in history and
sure.
talk about subs right after World War II and what was going on there, you know, what technology and that sort of thing?
There were two things driving it. One was the shock of what the Germans had accomplished. Not that they accomplished something terrific in war. They lost the submarine war. But in 1945, they were ready to come back with both fast battery subs and what we call warfare subs, hydrogen peroxide subs.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sense that, number one, submarine in the future might be a lot harder to hunt. And number two, we had to be able to understand the technology, both because we would like to be able to use submarines ourselves, and because if you have submarines, then you get insight into how to deal with the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians had captured most of this German stuff, and there was an assumption that they would soon be mass-producing it, which would be absolutely devastating.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, first, can we produce something that we can practice on? And second, what are you going to do about these new kinds of subs? Now, the answer to the first one is, it turned out we could modify existing submarines for much higher performance. And we did rather well at that.
Mm-hmm.
Second was, we started talking about using submarines against Soviet subs. Submarines have been sinking other subs for a long time, but not on a systematic basis, and certainly there's only one submarine in history which can sunk another one while they were both submerged. That's a British sub.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to be able to do that. That leads to much better sonars. It leads to homing torpedoes, which is a very large effort. It leads to questions of other ways of doing anti-submarine warfare, a lot more interest in aircraft, a lot of interest in attacking submarine bases. And that was the original justification for post-war Navy attack aircraft, heavy attack aircraft. So submarines are part of that story. By about 1955, we think we can handle the battery subs. They'll make about 15 or 17 knots underwater, but not for very long, about an hour. So we think that problem is solvable, although it's expensive and it's kind of rough. When the nuclear subs come in, and we have the first one, which is Nautilus, it's ouch, because everything has changed. And the nuclear subs are much, much more difficult to deal with, even though initially they're pretty loud, and we can certainly track the Russians. For a while, we believe the Russians won't be able to get one for a long time. The intelligence was not terribly good. And then the Russians pop up with their nuclear sub, I think it's 59. And at that point, we're already worrying about what do you do about it. And that leads to a lot more work. It also leads to a decision that, at a certain point, future subs will all be designed primarily for anti-submarine warfare. And the Fletcher was actually the first of those special submarines. a submarine that was both anti-submarine and a normal sub, a fast sub. It was a revolutionary submarine.
Mm-hmm.
It sinks by accident. And that's a terrible shock because at the moment that it sinks, a large number of very similar submarines are being built, including ballistic missile subs, which are another very important thing. You can see all of these things start in World War II, but they're minor.
Mm-hmm.
World War II submarine for us is sink the Japanese merchant fleet and the Japanese Navy.
Right.
But the secondary things we do during the war turn out to be very important later. So, for example, the idea of using a submarine for strategic attack, which is now a very big thing.
Right.
We didn't use it for strategic attack, but we did use them to attack land targets. One of the submarine commanders carried around rockets and fired them at the shore of Japan. He may be the same guy who landed people who blew up a Japanese train on tracks. And the British did the same thing. They used them to land special forces. Special forces get to be a bigger deal post-war. They used them to ambush enemy subs. But as I said, there's only one case in history in which they do it completely submerged. That's an amazing case.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't us. And then there's a lot of work on, well, could you do what the Germans did? And we try a lot of different kinds of engines, most of which don't work. That program is where nuclear subs come from.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's a funny story because there's a submarine conference in 1948, I think, and they're all miserable because the technology that they're working on has no commercial value.
Yeah.
So no company that does a contract is really willing to put much effort into it. And then Rickover, who's been a captain, gets up and he says, look, I'm working on this atomic stuff. And all of these companies think that's the future. So they put their best people on. They build me labs for free. They're really hot to trot. And up until then, people imagined that nuclear would be, you know, like 30 years away. All this other stuff would come first. And you constantly see that in internal correspondence, both in the United States and in Britain. So I've been looking at British stuff lately.
Mm-hmm.
And that turns out to be the one that works. Everything else goes down the tubes. The British actually build a hydrogen peroxide sub, in fact, two of them. Neither of them has a very good life. Hydrogen peroxide is horrible stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to explode if you touch it. In fact, they also had hydrogen peroxide torpedoes, and one of them blew the front end off a British sub. So it turns out that this technology that everyone thinks is way in the future is the one that comes off, which is kind of interesting.
Huh.
I should say the Russians also tried hydrogen peroxide. Their hydrogen peroxide subs blew up under the Baltic. And I think they barely made it to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't think they wanted to repair it. Good idea.
Huh.
So that story is quite dramatic. And then when we find out there are problems with pressure, it's, oh my God, what went wrong? And there are other things that they're worried about at that time also. The story on Thresher also has some politics in it, as in, not my fault, not my fault.
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting about the new material that came out is that you can put together a fairly plausible story of what happened, where past stories, I think, have not been very plausible. And ultimately, the saddest thing about Thresher is that they thought they were going to save themselves by blowing the water out of their ballast tanks. And it turned out no one had ever tested that system because it was so simple. Everyone assumed it would always work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Murphy's Law says that's when you should watch out.
Right.
And it's proved out that that's the thing that failed, after some other things failed.
Mm-hmm.
And they only learned that when they tested it afterwards. It's the saddest thing. Because it wasn't some kind of major mistake in building the Saab, although there seem to have been mistakes. But this one thing was horrible. And it was fixed.
Mm-hmm.
The other one is a submarine called Scorpion, which sank, I think, in 68. And with Scorpion, there were all sorts of weird stories about what had happened. For example, there's someone who peddled a story that he was investigating a Russian exercise and they sank it. And I don't even say proof of that, but it made a good story. Then there was another story that they had tried to fire a torpedo and the thing had come back and hit them.
Yeah.
And then finally, this guy looks at the data and it turns out that we had picked up sound that corresponded to what happened to the sub. It turned out that what happened to the sub was a battery explosion, which happens to submarines.
Mm-hmm.
It sunk other subs before, but never nuclear subs. And once you understood that, everything else was pretty obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And although that was not the published problem, one of these guys found out that right afterwards, strangely enough, they circulated notices from submarine commanders to were something a lot more nervous about their batteries.
Mm-hmm.
Batteries used for reserve power. And there was a very plausible explanation for what had happened. It's not a happy thing, but it's better than having the Russians kill you.
Right.
And it's better than having some other weird accident. I had thought the weird accident story was correct from what I had read of a partly declassified account.
Mm-hmm.
And no, that's not true, sir. You do it right.
Right.
That was interesting. It was interesting because at the time the Thresher sank, there was a lot of talk about, well, we went too far, there were too many new things in this sub, that was stupid, blah, blah, blah. And it turned out that the new things from the sub had nothing to do with what killed it.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, they would probably have survived if blowing the tanks had worked. They had serious problems with the machinery. They learned that they should be able to restart faster and things like that. And those were valuable and unfortunately very expensive lessons.
Mm-hmm.
But the fundamental problems of the design just weren't there.
So,
and that was very striking when you read the internal documents.
Yeah.
It had been a controversial enough design that they called a special conference on it, I think in 1959, and the notes of this conference were declassified. And boy, they were interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But they explained what people were trying to do. And you could see that yes, indeed, they took a lot of steps, but those steps didn't happen to be what filled us up.
Hmm. Interesting.
So that was interesting in itself. There were other bits and pieces. Most of the work I did was on where have we gone since I wrote.
Hmm.
But I enjoyed collecting new information, and it made things clearer. There was a very large submarine we built called Triton, which was a fast sub.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always curious as to why that was done. And it turned out that, yeah, when we do the fast sub, and there's a file that says, well, here are the different things you can do. And they picked one. But I had never seen the accounts before. If you do my kind of history, you want to know as opposed to guess. And so it's a somewhat different experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I like seeing the actual documents. I've seen so many guesses that were wrong in this business.
Yeah. Huh.
I'm doing a British submarine book right now, and so many of their writers will say, well, we know this and we know this, and therefore I connect them up. And then you go a little further, and you find out that, no, not two other things happened in between.
Huh.
And in cases where I can't see what happened in between, it really gets me. Because, you know, documents disappear.
Oh.
out of no business. Government's producing incredible amounts of paper.
True.
Archives misfile things. I'll give you an example, not to, for this book. I do a lot of work in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And they collect a lot of the key documents in big scrapbooks for covers, which I've been lucky enough to use.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working at British subs, and I get to the last one built during World War II. So I'm really curious as to what the logic was and what they tried and where they were going and things like that. What do you expect? Well, it's missing. And I know the guys who run the office where these things are kept. And they're very good people. Very, very good. They can't find it. And they really can't find it. And it's listed as being there, but who knows? I don't know if someone dumped it in the wrong box. And we're talking about something like 800 boxes of very large, heavy paper, which means it'll never be found.
Right.
Or someone walked away with it, it was an authority. Or someone stole it. Or it was in a mess and it was given to the conserving people.
Mm-hmm.
Never remembered to send it back. I don't know. I don't think there's anything in it that anyone would be the slightest bit embarrassed by.
Right.
It's one of those, I don't know where this thing is. I mean, in the United States, a friend of mine sent a paper to be Xeroxed in the National Archives many years ago. No one's ever found it afterwards.
Oh, really?
It's stuck to the battleship. It's nothing that anyone cares about. Got lost.
Yeah. Misfiled.
You're talking about places where there are millions of documents. God knows where we
Yeah. So you talked about, can you talk about, between like 1970 to 94, were there any other interesting things that you came up with that, you hadn't realized before?
I think mostly it was, I found that most of my guesses weren't bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's one type that's still operational that I'd like to know more about, but I'm not going to find out for a while. Most of that was good. The stuff that had been declassified was particular items. And they were interesting enough to be worth the effort.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the effort in writing the book was to try to explain what had happened since 1990, roughly.
Mm-hmm.
I was present for a little of that, sort of at the edges. So I had some sense of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And what was going on was suddenly there wasn't any more money.
Right.
So if we wanted to keep building subs at all, we had to be a lot smarter. And I can talk about what the a lot smarter was.
Oh, yeah.
There's a problem that when the money goes down, you have to keep at least some of the shipyards going. Otherwise, you'll never get them back.
Right.
And the question is, how much are you willing to spend to make sure they stay in business? And what happens is that if you try to keep them in business at a relatively low rate of production, you're going to pay a lot more for each sub.
Mm-hmm.
So I still remember a meeting I was in many years ago where we're talking about what the next sub should be like. And I said what I thought, and someone said, "You can't do that, you can't afford it." And I said, "Look, if I take a piece of paper and I call it a submarine, you'll find out that you have to pay hundreds of millions of dollars for nothing because you have to keep these yards alive. To keep a yard alive, you have to pay a lot of overhead. And it's worth it. It's worth it for the country to have that capacity."
Right.
This is not a matter of somebody enjoying himself at the public expense. Submarines do not have commercial application that allows you somebody to convert to being something else. After World War One, they had a very, very bad time, same way. And we're smarter now. Well, for that matter, after World War II, the business almost collapsed. For good reason. I mean, we had hundreds of submarines. How many do you need?
Right.
And once we found out that we could modify existing ones to be pretty damn good, that would certainly raise questions about why you need new ones. And the numbers go way down. And I'm sure the prices go way up as a result.
Right.
So, at the end of the Cold War, we were building, I think, 5 a year. And then it goes down to, what, like 2 every other year? Something like that.
Hmm.
It's a much lower rate. You can't go above those rates because there's only so much money and there are so many people.
Right.
And although the submarine service itself doesn't have a lot of people in it, the support is not cheap.
Mm-hmm.
And you would, if you're a submarine guy, you would much prefer to have that support than take a chance on, you know, shoes. That's it.
And I guess submarine crews are generally more expensive than regular ship crews. They get extra pay and such, don't they?
Well, they do that, but also I think there's probably a much higher percentage of extra qualified people.
Mm-hmm.
So you pay more every time you have to get somebody highly qualified. You as a citizen. And so the higher the percentage of highly qualified people, the more the crew is going to cost.
Mm-hmm.
I think very often when people talk lovingly about how they're going to cut the number of people, like, for example, in LTA, it's a low-crewing trip, although I think it's too low-crewing.
Mm-hmm.
Those individuals are going to cost a hell of a lot more than the average.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be more experienced, they'll be higher rates, they'll be specialists of various sorts. You really don't want somebody who's never been in the Navy before to drive a submarine 25 knots in the water. Might be a little embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, the people who maintain in the shipyards are probably special.
Right.
You need special facilities to handle special steels that are made out of and things like that. One of the things they did was to cut the number of refuelings. Because every time you refuel a nuclear sub, that's when the money is spent. That's also when new things tend to be put in. So, one of the big deals is we went to one-shot reactors. You don't get refueled. It's designed in such a way that it'll live the life of the boat, which is also kind of impressive.
Huh.
And that's only been possible, I think, in the last, say, 5 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at Virginia Class. I guess it goes back more than 5 or 10 years.
Okay.
But that was a big deal in the design. So that was a recognition that it's not just what you pay when you buy the stuff, but it's your ownership cost.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people who look at costs don't realize that it's both. In a lot of cases, I suspect ownership costs are more than buying the stuff.
So right after the Cold War ended, was there a lot of argument about even a justification for having a submarine force at all? I know long term you definitely would want to keep it. But were there, you know?
Yeah, there were discussions. I remember some of that. I remember one where, well, what are these things doing that's worth it? And it didn't help the Navy that the Cold War role that was most like what they would need afterwards was the one they didn't talk about, which was reconnaissance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a funny thing because you really don't want to talk about it. On the other hand, if you don't talk about it at all, people won't realize it's kind of important, and they'll throw you away.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that the Navy released some of those things to let people know that, yeah, we do this other job, it's still very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
There was that. There was a special forces stuff. I think, once 9/11 happened and there was a sense of, you could get stuck in a lot of nasty places, that helped bring back a certain realism. But the reconnaissance business was very important and it was very easy to miss. The other thing they did, there's a captain named Craven who was involved in very deep sea operations. Mostly in recovering things from the bottom. And that was a very secret operation, and he leaked it. they were about to scrap the sub that was used for that job. And I think the leak is what saved the program.
Hmm, I see.
And that was a very valuable thing during the Cold War. We would pick up bits of things that the Russians had dumped in the ocean. Like, for example, if they fired a missile into the ocean, we could pick up the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
That was extremely helpful.
And you said he revealed that during the Cold War?
No, right afterwards.
Right after. Okay.
There was a leak on the front page of the Times.
Hmm.
And it was sort of obvious why he leaked it.
Right.
He was kind of a maverick, and he has some pretty weird theories about things that had happened. But this one, I think, was public-spirited and very helpful.
Mm-hmm. So when considering shipyards, how much extra sort of equipment or specialized equipment does a shipyard need to build a sub versus a regular warship?
Oh, I think there's a lot. I think that you have different steel.
Mm-hmm.
I think that handling the reactors needs to have to be specially certified. That's why there's so few yards that build subs.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect that you have to certify welds more seriously than elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
The ocean is not a very nice place.
Right.
You probably have to have workers who are better at very tight pipe work, because the smaller the ship is, the tighter it is, the messier it is to build. That so many people don't realize when they think smaller is cheaper. It is in some ways, but the smaller it is, if you have to pack a lot into it, the messier it's going to get. So there are only two submarine yards, is Electric Boat and Newport News. There used to be a lot more. I think nuclear cut it way down because you had to be specially certified.
Mm-hmm.
With Newport News, they're also certified for nuclear carriers. So some of that has to work for both.
So,
and of course, yards stay a lot farther by doing refit work. On the other hand, if you cut down to only one shot reactors, that's going to cut down the work they get.
Right. Yeah. So many factors that feed into each other.
Oh, of course. That's why it's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So how many different... Yeah. So how many different submarine types are listed in the book?
Oh, jeez. It's a lot. there's a Guppy, which is the conversion of World War II subs to high-speed underwater power. Then there was a class called Tang, which was built from the start as a high-speed diesel sub. And I think there are variants on that. There are diesel missile subs for air-breathing missiles, one of which is on display in New York. It's Growler.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's Nautilus. There's Trident, which was a fast nuclear sub that was never reproduced, which must have cost a fortune. There was a class called Gate. There was Tullaby, which was a special anti-submarine sub, except it was a very slow one. And they decided they wanted a universal sub. That was a very interesting thing in the U.S. Navy, that we prefer a single type. If you look at other navies, they don't. If the missiles had been just a bit smaller, I bet the missile sub would have been the same kind of submarine with a different weapon on board.
Hmm.
Anyway, it's Thresher and it's Professor Sturgeon. There are the big ballistic missile subs, of which there must be three or four basic types.
Mm-hmm.
The Trident subs being the survivors. But there were at least two classes before that. There was George Washington. Oh, and I forgot Scorpion, which was a high-speed sub, but loud.
Mm-hmm.
Just before Thresher. Then there's Los Angeles, which is the mass-production fast submarine of the late Cold War, of which some still exist, which is why very little of their early history has been specified.
Ah, I see.
The thing I would like to know about them, which I never found out for sure, was exactly what the basis of the design was. And there were different explanations, one of which was that once the Russians had nuclear subs, they could go after fast carriers. So this would help that. And I never knew enough about their origins to be certain of whether that was what they really wanted or whether it was an excuse. There were people who hated Rickover would say an excuse. I'm more agnostic about Rickover. I don't think he was as strange as people make him out to be. But that may be because I never met him.
Yeah.
There was an abortive missile sub that he pushed that shows, and its failure shows that he was not all powerful, which is interesting. Trident, as I said, the current one is Virginia. And then there are the Trident conversions to special forces and guided missile subs, cruise missile subs. I think that's it. I bet I've left things out.
So, and your book has schematics and technical specs of all these subs. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. You wouldn't want to buy one that didn't.
Oh. I just want to let my listeners know that it's not just a narrative. It's a very detailed look at the subject.
Well, I also try to talk about the equipment and the sonars and things like that, and also why. That's the biggest question.
Mm-hmm.
Why did it all happen? And I think that's really where I differ from most people who produce these things.
Mm-hmm.
My concern is to explain what the Navy was trying to do. I've been criticized for not evaluating things. But the more that you know about individual ships, the harder it is to say this one was good and that one was bad.
Yeah.
And also, you feel like they're your children. You can't be nasty about it.
So
but basically, not having been on board these things for many years, I can't tell you which ones worked and which ones didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the record doesn't really help you. And the worst of it is, even if you were somebody on board one, you wouldn't be on board enough different ones to get a sense of what worked and what didn't.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't compare. Huh.
That's right. And I found that difficult from the start when I've been writing these things.
Mm-hmm.
I was once in a bookstore where someone said he couldn't stand my stuff because I didn't say which was better than the other. Well, the more you know, the harder it is to get smart about that.
Yeah. I think it seems like the only way you could really know is if you sat around with a bunch of retired captains, sub-captains, who might
have... have to be guys who had individually experienced a lot more different stuff. That would be the problem.
Yeah.
So, for example, if you get a guy who was on attack subs, because these things stay in production for so long, the odds would be too good that they would know a series of submarines which were basically the same.
Mm-hmm.
And the other problem is that they don't like to say bad things about ships they commanded.
Oh, yes.
That's not a real big surprise.
Yeah.
I remember one guy, I was writing about destroyers, and someone had told me that there's a class of diesel-powered destroyer escorts that always stank at diesel oil. So I said, you know, did you have that kind of problem? Oh, no, my ship was always clean. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah.
I didn't go to sea on board that night. And if you went to sea for only a short time, you wouldn't have any basis for being smart. I mean, I did sea on a destroyer. It was a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know anything about that ship from that experience.
Yeah.
All I know is I had a good time.
Right. I think it seems like historic war gamers especially want to know stuff like that so they can, you know, achieve the highest level of realism. But like you say, you know, how can you really know?
Well, more than that, and the problem with doing it that way is that the crew on board the sub makes a hell of a difference.
Yeah.
And so when you act as though every ship of this type is the same, no, it's not. I can't evaluate. I can't be smart about the differences. But, boy, there are differences.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed away pretty much from those kinds of questions because they're so difficult to handle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's just impossible.
So what resources... Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's the same with anything that you like.
Mm-hmm.
Especially with a sub that operates by itself. The CEO of the sub makes a hell of a difference. And what can I tell you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just working on British World War II. So I read an account of British submarine operations by a retired British submarine officer. Very senior.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific stuff. But how can I tell who was good and who was bad, and who had more nerve, and who was more skillful in evading counterattacks? And the ones that got killed, was it their fault, or would it have happened to anybody? Duh.
Right. Yeah.
And there's a large element of duh in there.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are limits to how good you can be as your snide.
Right.
Let's try.
Yeah. So what resources do you use for this particular book to do your research and get all that data?
It was mostly stuff in the National Archives of College Park.
Mm-hmm.
We don't keep ship covers like the British do, but we do keep papers on preliminary design.
Mm-hmm.
That, for the original book, I was lucky that there were a lot of papers from the OPNAV Undersea Warfare Division that the Navy kept that they let me see.
Mm-hmm.
That was at the Navy Yard. For what came out afterwards, there was a very nice file at College Park on modifications to ships.
Mm-hmm.
And that had a lot of material. That had stuff. Nautilus had a very bad noise problem, and they had a lot of very interesting accounts of what that was and of what the solution was. They had some design material on some of the nuclear slopes up until about 1963. And since that's when the Thresher design was really sealed up, that gave me a very good sense of what that was.
Hmm.
So I had also had some contact with the Navy. They could help with the past.
Did you happen to use any mission logs or mission books for any reason?
No. Because I'm not really writing about operations.
Right, right.
And my experience with logbooks, well, with the sub, there are patrol reports. The patrol reports of nuclear subs, I think, have all been classified.
Hmm.
But I've never used them because it's too much.
Mm-hmm.
To go through them, if you had a particular submarine you wanted to know about, it would be terrific.
Mm-hmm.
But we're up to, the high 700s. And we started World War II in the high hundreds.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were interested in submarines that did a lot, and that's really World War II and afterwards, the amount of material would be unbelievable.
Yeah.
But making sense of it would be even more unbelievable. Because this is too much.
Yeah.
You want to have a finite job. I don't know if that sounds chicken. But I'm interested in the Navy as a whole. I'm not a particular submarine person.
Right.
So, and I'm interested in the British Navy also because it's sort of like us.
Mm-hmm.
You have to limit what you're going to go after. It's hard enough to find out why they came out like they did. And if you're lucky, what you find in those papers are, when so-and-so was being attacked, this and this happened, and that's what we think.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, I think you just get lost.
Right. Hmm. So, I think you...
The logs themselves are just basically not very useful. Hmm. But the patrol reports are quite good. I take patrol reports.
Hmm.
And for World War II, I think they're all online.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But again, I'll leave that for other people to go through.
So, I think you might have mentioned this already, but what did you find in your research for this update, this revised edition? What most surprised you?
Well, the prizes were all in that file in College Park.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised. Well, I had a pretty good idea of the outline, okay? I'm fairly aware of how things work.
Mm-hmm.
But that wonderful 1959 conference on Thresher, that was an eye-opener.
Mm-hmm.
It was an eye-opener because I hadn't realized when they got really interested in quieting, which is what Thresher is about. The stages of the design were not at all what I had imagined. It's not like something scandalous. It was just something I really hadn't figured out.
Right.
And I'd seen a lot of paper before, and none of it prepared me for that.
Hmm.
It was much closer to being an evolution from something before in steps.
Mm-hmm.
And the steps were not the ones I had guessed. So that was very interesting.
Did you come across a lot of other conference papers as well, which seem more in line with what you thought then?
Oh, no, I'd never seen anything like that. The conference existed because there were protests against building this radically different sub, and boy, this is not a good idea, you're pushing it too far, and this is dumb. What happened was that a very senior submarine officer, who had been commander of the Nautilus, protested up the line.
Hmm.
And you gotta figure out how to talk this one out. We gotta talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody involved in the design shows up and explains what's been going on. Now, a lot of explanations may not quite be what happened because people's memories will be not exact. That's life.
Right.
But this stuff was interesting enough that I thought it was well worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting enough that I thought it was necessary to put in an extra chapter basically saying, here are things that are new. Mm-hmm. That and the Scorpion and Thresher lost stories were new. I thought those deserved to be told.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly Scorpion, Thresher, the story wasn't that different from what people believed. Scorpion it was.
Right.
That was real interesting.
Yeah.
It's horrible writing about people getting killed that way, but it was very interesting that it was so different from what people had imagined.
Yeah. So, apart from simply providing information to readers, what do you hope, sort of on a grander scale, that the book might do?
Well, it might give them a sense of why things have happened and how people thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that there's very little attention given to why.
Mm-hmm.
Except if people have conspiracy theories or something like that. But there's a reason that we have the Navy we have. And, well, there are reasons. Say a reason's kind of dumb.
Mm-hmm.
And my hope is that those who have the Navy of the future get a better sense of where things came from. You know, a lot of people think the world started about 3 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very unfortunate.
So would you say the book is written for a more sort of sophisticated reader who understands the Navy better than, say, just...
Yeah, that's true. I don't think someone who knew nothing would really want it.
Hmm, okay.
That's bad for an author to admit, but that's life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, yes. I think that I'm known to be a fairly sophisticated writer, and people seem to like that.
Well, I guess at a minimum, though, you can still get the book and look at the schematics, and that's...
No. There's no question that if you just want to look at interesting pictures of stubs and see what they were like, it's worth the trouble.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's not written in hieroglyphics. I hope it's fairly clear.
Mm-hmm.
And I do try to talk about what the world was like that these submarines were in. And I think that knowledge is rarer than you might imagine because a lot of the people who knew it are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And are leaving.
Right.
And that's the other thing. Very often when you read about some weapons or ships or airplanes, it's as though they live in this kind of vacuum. No, they don't. They're there because of the way the world required it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you talk about the larger world, it's all sort of fluff.
Right, yeah. See how it fits into...
I guess my hope has always been that someone in a professional history department bothered reading.
Right.
I mean, they're real lucky, but that's not.
Can you speak to any difficulties you had in getting this one finished or published?
It wasn't a problem.
No problem?
It's pretty straightforward.
Mm-hmm.
The publisher was friendly. They were very nice about what I had to do.
Mm-hmm.
The material was pretty straightforward. I had been very impressed during the last, say, 20 years with how the submarine service had adapted to post-Cold War.
Hmm.
Very smart people.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I felt it was worth having a revised edition was that the submarine world now is so different than it was during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Just the fact that they concentrate on the war that the country fights. And I think a lot of people don't understand that the Navy has been so involved.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all they think about is the Army.
Right.
It's
yeah.
unfortunate.
Yeah.
I'll give you an example. Many years ago, I was at a submarine conference in England. And there were a couple of U.S. government officers present. I think flag officers. And they gave a talk about, here's how the U.S. Navy submarines are helping fight the war against these terrorists. Very good talk. And I thought that they deserved to be remembered for that.
Mm-hmm.
That deserves to be out there.
Right.
More than just in a nice conference in a British think tank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And incidentally, there were a wonderful contrast to a British submarine officer who seemed clueless about this kind of stuff.
Hmm. Interesting.
So I think our guys deserve a bit better trumpet.
Mm-hmm. So,
they're good. They're really good.
Yeah. So what's your next writing project? I know this book is already been published. What are you working on now?
I'm finishing a book on British submarines up to 1945.
Mm-hmm.
After which, I hope there'll be one on British submarines after 1945.
Oh, okay.
And the fact that I've looked at U.S. subs is there's some insight into what the British were doing.
Mm-hmm.
British were very creative. After a certain point, they were very broke.
Yeah.
But this is really the era when they weren't as broke as they were later.
Mm-hmm.
Later, they were very smart, but we basically got the benefit of the smarts.
Hmm.
Which is, they're very creative. They're very good engineers. And what happens is, in a lot of cases, we have been the beneficiaries of how smart they have been,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of sad if you're British.
Yeah, yeah, I see. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
I mean, if you look at the inventions that they did, it's a very impressive record. If you look at the follow-up, it isn't.
Mm.
It's kind of depressing.
Yeah.
Well, it isn't depressing if you're American. We benefited.
Right.
But it would certainly be depressing if I were British.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not being able to take advantage of their capabilities, their own scientists.
Well, to some extent they were broke, but to some extent also, I think that their educational system, which produced their civil service, didn't do them a lot of favors on understanding technology.
Hmm.
I think that we are much better at that.
Huh.
Yeah. And if you don't understand what you can get, you tend not to do anything with it.
Okay.
So, in that sense, the story is kind of sad.
Yeah, yeah.
And part of it is no money, but part of it also is something about the way that they become civil servants or become important people in defense.
Hmm.
I find that very shocking.
Yeah.
And that goes back to that British guy who was the head of the submarine service, and I didn't find this explanation for what they were doing. Terribly impressive.
Yeah. Huh.
It may be just that he was horribly inarticulate, but it's kind of sad to watch.
Yeah. Huh. That's some food for thought, definitely.
Well, it's the reason I read about them as well as us is that their Navy thinks more like ours than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I can read the stuff. But also, I've learned how their Navy was organized. So one of your problems as a researcher is you're reading some paper. Captain X is writing to somebody else, and the question is, does it matter?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of Captain X's, a lot of what they write has absolutely no impact. So you have to be alert to who he's writing to and who he is, things like that.
Right.
Well, if I'm dealing with a Navy that I really don't know about, I can't make that kind of distinction cleverly.
Right.
At one time, I had a lot of access to French records, and I can read French. And I had no idea whatever who I was reading about. So I would never try to write that up.
Right.
It would be a disservice to the readers.
Right. Okay.
Where would the British stuff, not a problem.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so I guess all your books can be found on Amazon, and
sure.
you don't have a personal website, right? I think I asked you that before.
God forbid.
What's that?
God forbid. No, but I'm all over Amazon.
Okay.
And all over the Naval Institute.
Right, Naval Institute Press, definitely. So that's all the questions I have. Do you have any final thoughts?
No, I think you've let me blather enough.
No, it was good stuff. It was good stuff.
Good to talk with you, and thanks for calling.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for listening. One of the best ways to provide feedback on this podcast is to rate it on iTunes. Please let me know if you liked it, or give me a poor rating if you didn't like this podcast, and I can use that feedback to hopefully get better. Otherwise, please follow me on Instagram at Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945, on Twitter at War Scholar, on Facebook under War Scholar, and you can find more information on my website, warscholar.org. Please remember, my name Chris does not have an H, so it's CRISALVAREZ. Thank you, and I hope you continue to enjoy this podcast.